Thank you for having me here. I guess the first topic has sort of been covered here. I'm not Darren Grant. My name's Ken Clark, and I was asked to fill in for Darren kind of at the last minute. So it was unavoidable. I'm going to do my best to fill in. I've had the slides, this set of slides since this morning. So hopefully I've learned everything that I need to know in all of this. But there will probably be things that will come up that I will not be able to answer. Fortunately, Darren is still available. He's still online, and he is willing to answer your questions. So I will provide his email at the end. And if anybody has any questions that I can't answer, which could certainly happen, then he is very happy for you to email him. But otherwise, we will get through this together. We will work our way through these lectures and learn something, which I guess is the point. So yeah, I guess a little bit about me probably to start. As you heard, I'm a professor at Queen's University. I also did my PhD at Queen's University, which is not a requirement to be a professor here, but it just happened to work out that way for me. I did a number of postdocs. I started with my PhD in dark matter studies, actually, but then in my postdocs, I veered off into the neutrino world and kind of the high energy, cosmic ray type world, which was a lot of fun. And I had a good time, and I've continued that through a number of positions, a number of postdoc positions, and now into my position here at Queen's. I mostly still work on dark matter detection, but also on a few neutrino detection experiments and some high energy stuff. So that's just a little bit of who I am and the background that you're dealing with as we go through here. So this is where Darren's slides will start. So a lot of the material that Darren took was borrowed, in the sense that all academics borrow from each other, liberally from a number of sources. So there is content from all of the people here. Sorry, was that a question?
Yeah. Never mind.
Okay, so yes, we, as we do with these talks, we borrow liberally from a number of people, and the people are listed here. At the end, Darren was good enough to actually include some links to some of the sources for this. So if you see that there are names that you would like to follow up to get more information on, then there is certainly an opportunity for you to do so, and hopefully it will be easy. You can go to some of the people here, some of these links, and it will be available. So I meant to be talking here about cosmic rays. So we should talk now about where this whole thing began. And where this thing really began was with Wilson quite a while ago in around the 1900 era. So in that time, physics was in a wonderful age in which you could do all sorts of really neat experiments on your desktop. And you could investigate things on your own in small apparati, and it was a great time. And Wilson was doing this. Wilson was using an electroscope, which is the setup you see on the left of the picture here. So people have probably either used or seen electroscopes in the past. Essentially, what you have is just an insulating, an insulating container. There's some kind of conductor rod that goes down, and usually you have two very thin foils or something at the end of the rod. What you're looking for is you're looking for ionization. So any interaction between ions or free electrons and the kind of conducting rod or the foils will be passed down into the kind of testing edge. The foils will spread apart because they will have like charges. Of course, they'll repel each other. And then you can go on and you can measure the amount of ionization. So Wilson was doing this. He was, I believe, particularly interested in looking at moist air and how it conducted electricity, but then got really concerned at some stage about a number of different effects that could be going on. The first effect is a little bit irrelevant. It was that he was concerned about dust in the setup. The setup that the experiment you see on the left is actually sealed. There's the bulb at the top. There's a little kind of viewing telescope that you can look at it. There's a magnet. You can do all sorts of things, but it's all sealed in there so that he was very sure that dust didn't get in. That turned out not to be the explanation for the kind of increase in the ionization that he saw. So he thought about it some more and decided that there could be something coming down from the atmosphere that was causing this kind of extra ionization. And so he speculated this, and he decided the way to do this was go to this railway tunnel, which you see in the picture on the right here. Obviously not at the time he did it, it was an operational railway tunnel. Didn't have doors on it, for example. But this was the railway tunnel where he decided that the extra shielding on top would shield out all of the stuff that was coming from the atmosphere, and he could decide if that was actually a contributing effect. So he did this. He did it, obviously, at night when there was no trains running in it. And he did find that even in this kind of tunnel area, there was still a lot of ionization, a lot more than he expected, and attributed that to the fact that there was probably stuff coming down from the atmosphere. So, you know, there's something, like he says in the quote, radiation like Röntgen rays or cathode rays, they have an enormous power and they're coming down. I mean, he is kind of right. He got the explanation right for maybe not quite the right reasons. Of course, being in a tunnel in kind of a, you know, a limestone-y area, there was a lot of background radiation that was happening. That was probably more significant effect than the actual radiation that was coming from the sky, but certainly that did contribute something. So this was kind of the discovery that said, hey, there's something coming down from the sky and we should probably investigate. So good for Wilson. You know, he got it, even if not quite the right for the right reasons. So then there was another paper produced, which is here. So this is in 1909, obviously in not a condition or language I can read easily, but basically it's saying that there is gamma radiation coming down from the atmosphere. And this was another case where there was some proof that that a lot of the radiation is coming from the soil, but there is certainly a contributing effect coming down from the atmosphere. This was a much more correct interpretation. When you're at, of course, ground level and doing these tests, there is a lot of radiation coming out from the soil. It turns out cosmics account for probably 10% of the ionization at sea level. And people here are still using the electroscopes. They're still just looking at the ionization. So this is a step forward and the correct interpretation. So kudos, good job. And then people started to think a little bit more about how this was working. So one of the big questions was, what happens as you go up in the atmosphere? So we just said that at sea level and on the ground, if you happen to be at sea level, these cosmic rays account for about 10% of the ionization. So what if you get away from the ground? So there was this Theodore Wolff, probably in about 1910, who went to the Eiffel Tower and took measurements with his electroscope, both at the bottom and at the top. And what he found as he was doing these studies was that as you went from the bottom to the top, the rate went down, but it went down from something like 6 ions per cubic centimeter at the bottom to about 3.5 ions per cubic centimeter at the top. And that's about 330 meters tall. So this was interesting that it went down, but he had, the calculation had already been made in 1909 that they knew the attenuation of gamma rays. So if the gamma rays are coming up, they had expected that the rate should have halved in about 80 meters. So by the time you got 80 meters up from the ground, you should have seen about half the effect from the ground-based ionization. And that wasn't the case. It kept going and it took about 330 meters and you still didn't reach quite half. So this again was evidence that there's something coming from the outside. And then, like all of science or like all good things in the world, if, you know, some is good, then more is better. So if you can go a little bit higher to do your 330 meters, why not go way higher? So the Eiffel Tower may not have been exactly tall enough to figure out quite what was going on. So then there was Victor Hess. And Victor Hess did some amazing things in his study. So he did a lot of his studies from a balloon. So what he would do is he would take his ionization detector and he would put it in a balloon and he would go up to different heights. So that's pretty straightforward. I can get behind that. He went up in his balloon to about 5 kilometers above sea level, which I find incredible. There are lots of accounts of the kind of wonderful adventures that Hess had while doing this kind of thing and trying to take these measurements. But that's probably not the purpose of this. And I don't want to dwell. Darren would get upset if I dwelled on those stories. So what he found was that the ionization, the flux that he thinks he's measuring, decreases to about a kilometer and then starts to rise really sharply. So this was something that was a little bit unexpected, but he found that once he got up to about 5 kilometers, you had about doubled the rate from at sea level. So this was something where, you know, there's really something to behold here, where he had been looking at essentially a decrease going up, which was expected if it was all ground-based. Suddenly he sees this increase start, and then it starts to take off and become really significant as you go up. That's good. So there was a lot of explanations that people had put forward saying, oh, well, that's okay, but it's probably particles that are coming from the sun, or it's probably things like that. So the first thing he did was fly at night, which must have been quite an experience. I think landing a balloon is probably hazardous enough in the day, but he flew it at night, assuming, you know, the sun's on the other side of the earth, and he found exactly the same measurements. And I guess that wasn't quite exotic enough. He did also do a 5 kilometer ascension during a total solar eclipse, saying that, okay, well, if the, you know, if the moon is completely occluding the sun, then this can't be coming from the sun, probably. So just all of this said, he kept measuring the same thing over and over again. People were pretty convinced there's something coming out from something coming from above, not from the sun. And of course, Hess went on to win a Nobel Prize in 1936, I believe. So yeah, he did quite well. So then there needed to be more done. So the next step had to be somewhere where people were very concerned about background radiation and about the things going on. And any of you that have conducted experiments know that you can do your best to cut down background radiation, but sometimes it's actually a relatively simple experimental solution that turns out to be the best. And so this was a technique that was put forward in this paper. It's an extremely big deal, where people were looking for coincidences between two Geiger-Müller tubes. So I'm assuming people probably know Geiger-Müller tubes. I can't see your faces, but I'll assume that most people know, but it just basically, you have a charged wire through the center of a tube, which is the anode, and the tube is conducting, which is the cathode. So if you get particles going through it, any radioactive particles or anything ionizing, you create ions and free electrons, which drift. They get closer to the point of field generation. They accelerate, they generate avalanches. So it's a way to really amplify a signal from particles that are going through your detectors. So these were known at the time. Geiger-Müller tubes had been done. And this team decided that what they should do was actually put two of them together and look for coincident signals between the two, saying that if you had a coincident signal between these two Geiger tubes, essentially you had to have a particle come through both of them. So you were pretty confident that there had been some particle this way. Now, this opens up a whole world of things, not only the background rejection, which is of course significant and the reason it was done first, but you can start to try to determine angles of things. You can start to do all sorts of neat things looking with coincidences. So this team, they found that when they were stacked, so the two tubes were on top of each other, they did see coincidences. So they were seeing what they assumed correctly is particles coming down, going through both of those tubes, causing coincident signals. And when they separated the two tubes, the coincidence rate went down significantly. And they also found that if they put absorber in between it, they could, you know, also reduce the rate. So if they had stacked tubes, they put absorbers in between the two tubes, they could actually start to decrease the rate as well. So they were suddenly doing some really interesting work, not only looking at kind of the absorption properties and all sorts of stuff like that, but they were looking at the signals coming down, and they had incredible background reduction by doing this. And you can see in the plot that's included on this slide, you have this background reduction as you put this count reduction as you put the absorber through. So the rate of coincidences decreases with the amount of absorber that you put in between. All, you know, perfectly makes sense, very logical, excellent. So what one can do then is start to basically combine these two, combine the kind of altitude-based studies with this coincidence detector. And so you're cutting down a lot of the backgrounds that you might be worried about, and you can take this up in the altitude. And that's what was done here in this paper. You can see that at the bottom, you know, kind of where Hess had gone, which was on the upslope of this. So the axes are just the air pressure. That's the measurement in air pressure decreasing as you go along the x-axis, and the number of coincidences. So Hess had indeed seen this turn on. You know, the decrease is not visible on here, but you have this turn on, this sharp turn on of the rate. But this continues as you keep going up. And the really interesting part was it actually turns around as you get higher. So obviously this required equipment a little bit better than Hess had. Hess was doing all of this stuff in, you know, what you would think of as your traditional balloon, you know, wicker basket, you know, picnic, that kind of thing. He's just going up there measuring these things. But as you wanted to get higher, of course, you had to start enclosing the balloons. You had to do a lot of different stuff in order to, you know, you're going much higher in the atmosphere. So Botzer was able to go much higher in the atmosphere and determine this. And this was an incredible turnaround. And this is, this essentially sums up a lot of what happens with the cosmic rays is contained in this plot. It's all here. What you're seeing is you're seeing that there is something coming, and Botzer seemed to get most of this, I believe. You're seeing something coming from the atmosphere. So something's coming in, it's interacting in the atmosphere, and it's producing these, you know, these particles that are causing the ionization in your detectors. But as you go higher in the atmosphere, it increases and then increases very sharply and then drops off again. So the interpretation here, and the correct one, is that you actually need some of this material in the atmosphere to actually create the ionizing rays that were being detected. So you can see this turnover that says you have now gone up to where there is so little material, you're unable to correct this to create all of the interactions that you need to do all of the kind of the showers that you need and create all of the cosmic rays. So this is really interesting stuff. And it would go on to be, we'll talk a little bit more about further investigating it, but the whole idea to me of doing this stuff from balloons and measuring all of this stuff is incredible that they were able to predict this so well and find this so accurately. Anyway, it's an aside. So if balloons are good, you can probably still do better. And this is very, very cool. So, well, kind of. So the next step was to go even higher. And if you want to go past kind of outside of the atmosphere where balloons don't work, you're going to need something a little bit better. So that kind of leads to the two underlined things in this and the abstract of this paper, which are you can now take a Geiger counter and strap it into a V2 rocket and then fire it up, you know, away from the Earth. And this is pretty neat stuff. Here is the kind of schematic where you can see this is just your V2 rocket. You're able to send it up to 161 kilometers above, and it contains this ionization detector, the Geiger tube, or Geiger counter that you see here, that's recording all the time as it's recording this. So this was really kind of another big breakthrough in seeing this. They already knew what they would see in the kind of atmosphere region where, you know, you can see that, but what happens when you get outside of that? And this was the very dramatic way to do that. So take your detector, put it in a rocket, fire it up, which is cool. Wish I got to do physics like that. Maybe someday. But anyway, what you can see here in the plot that's attached is the results that they got. So they see the same thing that Hess saw and the same thing that Botzer saw, where you get this rapidly increasing rate, you approach a peak, it falls off. But what they found was it falls off and then becomes a steady state effectively for as far as they measured. You can see after about 50 kilometers above the Earth, suddenly things flatten out and you're in this nice flat region where it's all just proceeding along at roughly the same rate. So this gives you another key piece of information that says, yes, all of your interpretations before were probably correct. You have stuff coming in from space. It has to interact with the atmosphere in order to produce the ionization you see, but you can still interact with that stuff that's coming from, you know, outside the atmosphere. And there's a pretty flat rate coming from outside the atmosphere once you get beyond kind of the grip of the Earth. You see that there's this really relatively flat rate. So this is just the universe, or at least our, you know, our region of our galaxy is pervaded with all of these particles at a roughly constant rate. And all of this done by sending a Geiger tube up in a rocket, which is very cool. This is just kind of the same thing which you're seeing, where you can plot by altitude and you can actually start to do the intensity of these rays. So the plot in the top left is looking at the intensity. So how much, not only just did you see some ionizing radiation, what was the, you know, how intense, how energetic was that ionizing radiation? And the data that was taken from at least the three sources listed here were all in very good agreement. You start at a low altitude, you don't have a lot of ion pairs that are, you know, that are there. As you increase in your altitude up to about 10 kilometers, you start to see, yeah, the intensity is going up. So the energy of all of these particles is going up as you go higher. And then, of course, that turns around and comes back down, which, you know, was not able to tell from the data you have there. But we do know that it turns around and it comes back to being roughly GeV scale. So we're saying that this galactic cosmic rays are roughly GeV scale, which is pretty neat. So that's good. So now we've discovered we have an atmosphere, you know, the galactic cosmic rays, we know the energy, they're coming in the atmosphere. So what are they doing in the atmosphere that's actually, you know, that's creating the ionization? So the next study was to take two detectors, look for coincidences, but separate them from each other. So the idea here was, if you're looking at your two detectors separated and you're seeing the same thing in coincidence, you're essentially mapping out the area that is being affected by this event. So you have some particle coming down, it's doing some stuff, which we'll get into in a second. But then as you spread them out farther, you know, what is the kind of radius of the event that you're seeing? And this was really the discovery that there are showers of particles coming down, because they found that as you spread these out, you still see coincidences up to, you know, you're pretty far when you're talking about this kind of thing, you know, 70, 80 meters apart. You're still seeing these coincidences. So things are still happening that are together. You know, your background obviously is not zero, but you're cutting it down by looking for the coincidence. So there's causally connected things that are happening that far apart, which is very impressive. It gives really the kind of first measurement of the air showers themselves. I mean, we'll go on to talk a little bit more about newer measurements of this. Obviously, there's a little bit, you know, technology has advanced slightly since then, but this was a very neat measurement of the actual kind of spatial sense of the air showers. So, yeah, is there a question there?
Not sure what you mean by coincidence like that. It's like you get the same number in your two detectors.
Ah, no. So what I mean by coincidence, sorry, I should have explained this better. What I mean by coincidence is that you're getting two events that are happening at the same time in very big air quotes in your detectors. And so what you're assuming then is you're assuming that if you have two detectors that are separated by 50 meters, and they get the same, you know, they get an event happening at the same time, which probably, given the technology, probably means more like within, you know, a couple of nanoseconds or a couple hundred nanoseconds, maybe, then those are connected. And so they're saying that you're looking for where these things are connected in time. So if I keep spreading, if I put two things very close to tech together, then seeing them connected in time together is not that impressive, obviously, but as you spread them apart, you're still seeing things connected in time. So they probably came from the same source. So that's what they're doing here, is mapping out the kind of extent of that source. Is that cool?
Yes, sir.
Good. Anybody else? I tend to get a little excited and carried away with sometimes. So please do feel free to interrupt me. I don't mind at all. Okay. Then, so that's kind of the history of what's happened. What we want to know now is we're pretty sure there's air showers. Well, they're quite sure there's air showers. And now we're very sure there's air showers. So what is in these air showers? So what we need first is we need something that comes in from the galaxy somewhere. And so what's listed here is the, what we call the primary particle, or just the primary. It's listed as a proton here. It could be a proton. It's very common that it's a proton, but it could be a nucleus. It could be something heavier. And so what happens is you get something relatively heavy, like a proton or a nucleus or something, coming in, entering the atmosphere, striking a nucleus in the atmosphere. And this is where it all starts. So striking that nucleus, a lot of things happen. Essentially, you've got a lot of energy from this primary coming in, blasting things apart. So you're getting still, you know, protons and neutrons, but you're also getting a lot of things like pions that are created just because essentially there's a lot of energy around and you're able to create these particles. So we see that this primary has created, you know, protons, neutrons, and some charged and neutral pions. So, you know, that's something that we understand happens. So we can follow kind of one side of this, which is we can go to we can follow the neutral pion. So neutral pions decay with the electroweak interaction. They produce two photons. Okay, so now you've gone from your primary, which is this proton, it's gone in, exploded things, you've created two photons. But those two photons still have a ton of energy, probably not a literal ton. They have a lot of energy that they're doing. So those two photons will go on to do a lot of other things. They will pair produce, get electron and positron pairs. And then those electrons still have a lot of energy and positrons. They can go on to produce more photons, which can then go on. You see how this kind of rattles on and why it gets into kind of the discussion of an air shower. So all of this can happen. The pair production can happen mostly because you're in the atmosphere. There's lots of stuff, lots of nuclei around and stuff to allow that to happen. You've probably all covered things about pair production and things. So that's something that you've done. So we have this kind of branch that goes on. You created a neutral pion. It created all of these photons and things. The other particles have gone on to also do a lot of things. So the pions, the charged pions can go on to essentially mimic what the primary did. So they can go on to strike more nuclei, blast more things apart, create more charged pions and more neutral pions. But here we're just dealing with the charged pions. So we're going through and we've created all of these particles again. So all of those, the charged pions, some of them have gone in to do this. They've created this kind of hadronic, you know, you've created all these hadrons that are going down and showering down. And then finally, the charged pions again, there we go, they can also decay into muons and neutrinos and antineutrinos, but the neutrinos we're not really concerned about here. So we'll just say that they decay into muons. So they are creating their own kind of path. And you can see with the kind of coloring, it's leading you into doing an interpretation, which is we have three kind of components of this shower. We have an electromagnetic component, which is all the basically everything that's associated with the photons that are going on there. We have the hadronic component, the kind of the more things are just smashing apart. And we have the muonic component where you have your pions that are decaying down into muons. And so these three elements are all there, are all present in your showers and are all creating signals which may be able to be, you know, detected later, which would be fun. So here's some statistics. So if you have a 10 to the 15 EV proton as your primary, by the time you get to the ground, you get to 10 to the 6 particles, which is, you know, a lot. You started with one, you have now 10 to the 6. That's pretty good. 80% photons. There are a lot of photons generated, you know, roughly 20% electrons and positrons. So that's everything in the electromagnetic channel. You can see that it is making up the absolute lion's share of the decay is going through this electromagnetic channel. Around 2% goes into muons. And then you have a little bit left, you know, 0.3% into kind of these hadrons. And what's shown in the neat kind of sketchy line version here is a simulation, and I believe it actually is the 10 to the 15 proton, where the color matching is the same as the color matching that's in the explanation on the left. You have the hadrons, which are kind of going down the center. You're getting this kind of very linear progression, very forward peaked progression as for the hadrons as they go through. You're getting the muons, which are also more or less straight down, but of course they have had this hadronic component, so they shifted out a little bit, and then the muons have spread somewhat. And then you have the electromagnetic component, which is spread considerably more. You're tracing all of these electrons, positrons, and gammas through all of this, you know, this much larger area. And this is exactly what I was trying to get at with the separation of the detectors. So here you can see that there isn't a physical extent to the shower, where you're looking at the, you're actually able to trace it out and see that there is some radius on the ground in which particles are associated with the shower itself. So this is kind of the start of the whole air shower array thing. So that's, this is one of the keys to kind of detecting cosmic rays, is having them interact in the atmosphere, having them do all of this stuff. So if you want to measure these air showers, what you really want is you want something really big. Ideally, you would have things that are much, much bigger than the extent of the air shower itself, right? You'd want to be able to detect all of these air showers as they're coming in from all around. That's really difficult. Finding just the kind of geography and the detectors to instrument a large area like this in order to actually detect these large air showers is really challenging. So what people have moved to is kind of, in some ways, an updating of the moving the two detectors apart. You have many detectors distributed out, an extended array in which you're looking at detecting some of these particles, and then you're combining the signals together later to say that you saw this air shower. So this, what's shown here on the left of the kind of slide, is an illustration where you can have this, I guess, star-shaped detector, and you have your shower that's coming in, represented by all of this kind of cloud of dots here, coming in, and you're going to be able to detect that on your, in your array itself. So this saves you from trying to actually work through and have this giant detector. You're able to do it in a distributed way. So the way that that works is much like what's shown in kind of the sketch on the right here. There are detectors at the top. These are, you know, these panels which contain scintillators in this case, and the light is detected by a tube, a photo tube, and then the signal is relayed. So what's being shown is you have this shower coming in on an angle. It's hitting these different detectors, and the signals from these detectors are being pushed into a coincidence unit. And if they are in coincidence, much like we talked about earlier in time, then you can start recording the peaks that are found from these from the signals that are coming in. And there is a lot that you can do with this, in fact. Of course, you can get timing differences you know, between the different panels. So if you set your coincidence wide enough, you can start to see from the timing differences that you can detect the angle at which this part, these particles were coming in, because of course, in this case, they'll hit the detectors on the left first and then work their way across to the right. So if you have a wide coincidence window, you can actually see this happening, and you can decide that this is the direction, you can count, trace back to the direction from which the particles came. You can also do things like look at how many of these are hit, look at the intensity of the peaks in the detection itself. From that, you can determine the energy of the air shower. So this is becoming, we're starting to get away from, you know, proving that air showers exist. Everybody's quite happy with that. But now we're looking at the finer detailing the air showers, investigating what is making them up, how energetic are they, where are they coming from, all of that kind of thing. So this is kind of the start of the generation of further defining all of the air showers themselves. And this led to, this was in when 63, this particle that said, there's evidence at this extended array for a cosmic ray particle with an energy of 10 to the 20 EV. That is an impressive number. 10 to the 20 of anything is an impressive number, but 10 to the 20 EV is getting really impressive. We'll figure out how impressive it is in just a second. But you can see here where in the kind of the diagram on the right, where you have this extended array of detectors, it looks like the center of it was kind of between two of your detectors, but all of these detectors managed to see something that happened when this was going on. And you're able to do some interpretation from this. I'm just gonna have to go and shut my window. They're filling the liquid nitrogen tank right outside my window. So just give me one second. Sorry about that. I mean, it would be nice. It's nice to have the liquid nitrogen tank outside when it's hot like today, but it's a loud thing to fill. So anyway, we're at this detector where the MIT people have found this 10 to the 20 EV, and it is a really neat picture. Just as an aside, the picture on the left is a very neat one where the detectors, so those are just scintillator detectors on the ground there covered with hay. The hay is presumably to keep them dark and to be able to actually, keep them protected when they were installed. So interesting. Anyway, we're starting to see, to be able to categorize the cosmic ray showers coming down with energy. And so that is going to lead us to being able to actually create a plot that looks a lot like this one. So what's being shown here is the flux of particles on the y-axis and the energy on the x-axis. So there is a ton going on in this plot. It's incredibly interesting, but I think we should just take a second and look at a few things. So the first thing is to look at the scale of the particles that you're looking for. So very helpfully, because I don't find meter squared per stradian per GeV per second very a unit I can interpret easily, but there are some kind of guideposts marked here where you can get one particle per meter squared per second around here, a particle per meter squared per year around here. Once you get into the higher energy, a particle per kilometer squared per year. And then once you're at the highest energy, you're talking about a particle per century.
Sorry, we can't see your cursor.
Oh, sorry. Go. That does make it more challenging.
There it is. There it is.
Nice. What happened? My bad. So you see as I was saying, particle per meter squared per second, per meter squared per year as you increase in energy. Once you get up into the higher energies, you get a particle per kilometer squared per year, then a particle per kilometer squared per century. So once you're into these highest energies, you're really very rarely seeing anything. And if you recall, what I just told you was that this detector had seen a 10 to the 20 EV particle. So at the kind of footprint that it had, the odds of that are not great, but who knows? Maybe they did actually see one. So there's some other interesting guideposts on here. Also, this is all data from different experiments that have been combined together to kind of show the consistency of this curve. The other interesting parts are, what does this mean in terms of, what's an energy scale? So you can see here, the Fermilab, the collider at Fermilab at 2 TeV, it lines up about here. And at CERN, so the LHC at 14 TeV is roughly in here. So these are energies, particles of energies beyond anything we have the capability to produce ourselves. There's a lot of reasons why we can't produce them ourselves, and we will not likely ever be able to produce them ourselves. But it really kind of sets the stage for using these cosmic rays as a way to investigate a lot of the physics that's going on. So if we can get up into some of these energies up here, 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19, 10 to the maybe 10 to the 20 electron volts, this is really something that, it's going to be cool. But there are problems with this, of course. The rate here is the biggest problem. So if you're looking at, for example, an experiment with which I am pretty familiar, which is IceCube, which has roughly a square kilometer footprint on the top, you're looking at particles here being showing up like once per year. So you're looking at very rare detections. It is going to be very tough to find anything there. But this really is saying that we can use these particles to do things. And what we have essentially created for ourselves, well, not created for ourselves, but what we have created for our use is almost a traditional accelerator. So we have some acceleration mechanism somewhere out in the galaxy, we're gonna get to that, that's acting as our accelerator. It's taking a proton, it's accelerating that proton. Our Earth's atmosphere is providing a target for the proton to come in, interact, create this shower, and create this beam that goes through. So we are looking at an actual kind of an accelerator experiment. It's just not one that we have any control over. We can't, for example, shut down the signal at any time and be able to do anything like that. But we're getting a lot of energy, we're getting a lot of information for free from the atmosphere, which is cool. So now we can talk about what is it that's actually accelerating the particles to these energies. And that is a very interesting question, a question which is not solved yet. There are lots of theories out there, but there, you know, no conclusive evidence yet, for especially at the much higher energies. I think we understand some of the acceleration. What's being shown here is just there's kind of two regions that you can talk about the acceleration. And it follows more or less a power law over the entire spectrum. So this gives a lot of information about how the acceleration is occurring, but we're going to separate it into kind of the non-relativistic sources and the relativistic sources. So the non-relativistic sources cover the energies at lower energy ranges when we're talking about, you know, going up to, you know, 10 to the 16, 10 to the 17 EV, something like that. If you get higher than that, you really need relativistic sources to be able to do that acceleration. So that's what we're looking at here. So what is it that is actually doing this acceleration for us? So there's lots of sources that are being studied to do this. It's very challenging to study these sources, but there are certainly a lot of possibilities. So one possibility is that there's pulsars. The pulsars are this kind of hotbed of energy, hotbed of things going on. So there's a lot of potential for that, for those to be generating, accelerating particles at very high energies. The next potential class is supernova remnants. So we're gonna actually talk about those in more detail in kind of how we think that there might be an acceleration mechanism there. Active galactic nuclei, those are where there's a lot of kind of things going on with planetary formation and all sorts of star formation and stuff going on there, that there is energy being expended, so it's a possibility. And then gamma ray bursts are really kind of cool. We're not gonna talk about them here, but there's a lot of potential study for what's going on there. So I said we're gonna talk about supernova remnants. So supernova remnants, obviously, you know, you've had this star, it's gone supernova, it's collapsed down. And then after it collapses down, there's a shock wave that goes out from the collapsed star itself. So that shock wave is kind of this compressed, there's a shell of kind of hot gas, and then there's a shock wave that proceeds out through it. So what we have is we have sort of the precursors for what we need in order to do the acceleration. We have the particles to do the acceleration. We have this, you know, shell of hot gas here where there's lots of, you know, all sorts of things going on, free protons, maybe some heavier nuclei, maybe not, but there's lots of things in there. And then the shock wave proceeding through it that could do some acceleration. So the kind of sketch you're showing here is showing that, yeah, there's things coming out, there's, you know, electrons, you know, doing inverse Compton and producing gamma rays and stuff. There's protons that are coming from there, from the actual shell of hot gas itself that are being accelerated. And then there's, you know, if you happen to run into anything out there, if that shock wave runs into anything, you have more potential for accelerating things. So this is basically the collisions there's collisions going on in the shock wave. They accelerate the particles and then they produce showers. And it's really all about this shell of hot gas that's going on. So this is just kind of the supernovas that have been observed by I in the last 1,000 years or so, because they're very cool. In this case, they're you know, powered by something at the center, and the shell is very visible in these images. So you can pretty clearly see this shell that's going on around it. The one in the center, 1054, the Crab Nebula, is really the one that gets the most press, gets people most talk about most, because It is kind of the golden candle for measurements in our galaxy. People use the Crab Nebula to be able to see kind of the, you know, if you're building your detector, you want to prove that it works. You want to, you know, be able to kind of do some characterization. You're looking for the Crab Nebula, which is powered by a pulsar at the center here, as it says. But this is just kind of the, man, these are cool pictures stage of the talk. So we can get a little bit more sciencey here. I think the point here that is trying to be made is that we can get a scale for the acceleration itself. So we have, you know, all of this stuff which we talked about. The we have the kind of shell of hot gas and stuff that's being swept up in the shock wave that's going out. And so it's the as this evolves, you're getting accelerated particles coming out. And you're creating basically this beam dump because you're creating, you're accelerating these particles, you're putting them into something which is accelerating, you know, you're causing more and more particles to be produced, which you can accelerate. And then, you know, you're producing all this stuff, which is great. And this, I think the idea here is you can do just really very simple calculations and get some kind of idea of the energy. And the energy available here is really high. You're looking at 10 to the 51 ergs. Ergs is also not a unit that I am super familiar with. I couldn't tell you, you know, what an erg would do if you know, I had that much energy, but it is very good. And you're getting actual supersonic velocity of these things. So this is why you're getting this formation of shock waves. Basically, you have all of this energy being expended. You're creating all of these supersonic shock waves. You're creating all sorts of an atmosphere and conditions in here that are ripe for accelerating things. So these, there's that was for kind of the non-relativistic particles. If you're looking at the relativistic particles, then you can look at the particles that are being based on a few other different ways. These ones are kind of the shocks, and you can do the shock mechanisms here in a little bit of a different case. You're not looking at the supernova remnants there now. You're looking at different things, which we'll get into a little bit later. But you can see that you're able to generate these things. So I believe that the idea here was that we would go over a little bit of the of what was actually done in terms of math of producing these things. Like I said, I haven't studied this all myself. I'm going to assume it's probably right. Fermi did this. I'm very confident in Fermi's math. I have no problem with that. My math may leave a lot more to be desired. So we can go through, and I think that the point that we're working on here, essentially you're looking at elastic collisions of these particles. You have a magnetic field. You have your particle coming in at some angle. So you're gaining some energy as it goes back because you know, you have your kind of shock field moving and your particles coming in and bouncing back. So the head-on collisions are the most efficient, clearly, but you have these shock fronts and you have these shock fronts moving towards each other at different speeds. And so the way that this often seems to be discussed is with ping pong paddles. If you have ping pong paddles and you have them kind of, you know, facing each other, you have a ping pong ball in and you're moving them at, relative to each other, you can increase the velocity of the ball by moving these things and actually imparting energy to the ball and getting it to go between the two paddles. And if you look at the averages, you're looking here, if you average over the angle, you get this kind of relationship where the average energy is increasing by this factor. So 8/3 V over C, as you know, you get closer and closer, you're getting more and more efficient. As velocity gets closer and closer, you're getting more and more efficient to imparting energy on your particles themselves. So so then for each collision, the energy changes this way. But then you, of course, what you want is you want the, well, you don't want, what we need for our particles is you need these particles to be accelerated, to bounce back and forth, but then eventually escape, right? We need these particles to get out from this region and head towards Earth so that they can hit our atmosphere. And so you can study the kind of the probability. So you can set, basically, you can determine how many particles remain over a certain energy and what the probability is for them to leave over a certain energy. And you can go through, you just take the lawns and you do all the kind of basic math that you're all much better than me at doing. And you can end up with this thing that as you, as a function of energy, you're proportional to this, this energy to the lawn P over lawn beta minus one. So basically that's giving you the time constant between the scattering collisions where you're able to say that these are accelerating towards Earth. In terms of looking at, you know, kind of the diffusive shock, this is a slightly different way where you have particles, you have basically your shock wave moving through. As the shock wave moves through, you have particles in there, you have kind of the moving plasma of stuff that's coming with it and a stationary plasma, and the particles kind of wandering around randomly in here. But every time it crosses that shock front, it's getting some acceleration from that shock front. So you are gaining your acceleration mostly in the same direction through this random walk across the shock front. So this is in the environment, of course, of moving magnetized gas clouds. So a very unique environment in which you're able to do this by the shock wave moving through, you're able to have particles accelerated. And if you're looking at that, you can say it produces a power law distribution. The average change in energy is related to this, you know, V over C squared. And then you're, you know, with the velocity reference to the velocity of the cloud itself. Particle enters, it scatters, and it leaves with a new energy and a momentum, a higher energy and a higher momentum. So this is just the same thing again, I believe, shockwave. Oh, I see where we're going, I think. Apologies to Darren if he's listening, but I think I see where we're going. We're going to say that, you know, this particle is randomly wandering across this shock front between up and downstream. And then you basically, you're saying that they obey a power law. So if you have this atomic gas, you can actually determine that for non-relativistic versions, you can get down to this roughly, you know, e to the minus two, you're approaching e to the minus two. That allows you to say that there's a maximum of the attainable energy. And if you have supernova remnants in the kind of range that are shown here, you know, your field amplification, your magnetic field, you're getting into the 10 to the 14 EV. So that is roughly where we talked about before, where the break kind of happens between the non-relativistic acceleration and the relativistic acceleration. So the supernova remnant path is certainly on the non-relativistic side, but there are other mechanisms to do the relativistic side, which are kind of detailed here, where you can, you know, your maximum attainable energy goes with magnetic field strength and the size. So you're able to generate this 10 to the 20 EV, you know, it's kind of along this diagonal. And what it's saying is the magnetic fields become incredibly important in the acceleration mechanisms. So this represents the diagonal design represents what it takes to produce a 10 to the 20 EV proton, basically, is what falls along here. So all of these are not capable of producing this. And you can see supernova remnants we just discussed, not capable of producing the 10 to the 20. But if you get out to maybe active galactic nuclei are out there, you have galactic clusters, things like that, which have a relative, you know, the magnetic field strength and the size in order to do the generation to get the thing accelerated up to those energies. So this is something that you can look further into. It's really interesting stuff. There's one more, I think, mechanism which we wanted to talk about, which is looking at potentially getting more power. If we're looking at potentially doing kind of relativistic acceleration, how can we do that? That's where we talked about the active galaxies and things like that. And then you really need something that has a lot more potential than just the supernova remnant. I mean, I talked about how the supernova remnants, they're just this star that's collapsed into this gone supernova. You have shock waves going through all of the stuff that was left. This, you need something else. What you really need is some kind of either massive thing and likely a black hole, likely a very massive black hole. And it's got to be rotating. So we've got this thing where we're happening where your black hole is rotating and you've got stuff falling in towards the black hole and being accelerated along the axis of rotation. So along the axis, you've got stuff infalling coming in. It's being accelerated and it comes into contact with the rotation itself. Then you get into kind of really, really heavy GR type stuff where space-time is going around, it's dragging with it. That's not my forte generally. I'm going to assume this is all correct, but it's not kind of the thing I do. The thing I will talk about is that there's this plasma. So in around black holes, probably people know there's this accretion disk. So in that accretion disk, there's this spinning disk. It's got a lot of stuff going on, lots of free electrons, lots of particles, plasma spinning really quickly, and it's going out and then it's flung out. The material itself can be flung out along the field lines themselves. So this is kind of analogous if you're thinking of this kind of unipolar inductor engine. So what this says, I don't know if people have ever heard of this. It was called Faraday's paradox for a while or something, where if you can spin something in a magnetic field spinning in there, and especially if there's free electrons in there, you can actually get this quite a bit of power derived from that. That's what this sketch in the bottom right is showing. And you can, if you have this plasma that's going spinning around your black hole, you've essentially created this lots of free electrons spinning around in a magnetic field. So you've got the perfect conditions to do all of this stuff. I think earlier I was really kind of cavalier about saying, yeah, there's lots of energy, lots of things going on. That's perfect for acceleration. This is one of the mechanisms in which, yes, there's lots of energy, lots of things going on. It's perfect for acceleration. And if you start to look at kind of the numbers for the acceleration, which are run through in the kind of top here, you can get, you have the permittivity, you have the power, all of this stuff. So for the Crab pulsar, you're getting into 10 to the 31 watts, 10 to the 39 watts. Gamma ray burster, you're getting into like 10 to the 44 watts. We're talking about a lot of energy that's coming out here, and a lot of energy that's available for the acceleration of particles. And remember, that's before I started raving about all of these black holes and stuff. That's what we were looking for, was a mechanism to accelerate particles and create the cosmic rays at Earth that we want to see. So this is a really neat, these are really neat pictures. Oh, I lost my cursor again. There it is. These are really neat pictures in that you can see some of the stuff that's going on. So what we can see is that there's something at the center here. We can kind of very roughly see that there's jets. But of course, what we can see is based largely on the kind of, electrons and protons generating things being sent toward us. That's how we can see it. What we can't see is there's regions in here, for example, where there can be neutrinos generated, neutrino production. There's not a lot of gamma rays coming out. So while you have dark regions in here, you have kind of the big corona around here, you have this ring around, and then you have this area where in the kind of X-ray and other electromagnetic detection methods for our kind of electromagnetic showers, there's not a lot going on. But this is where the neutrinos and stuff come from. And I've always thought that was very cool itself. So we have generated something that looks a lot like this. We have black holes, we have, maybe neutron stars. Then we can generate something, we fire it, we can generate into the kind of interstellar medium where we have radiation, we have hydrogen, we have dust, whatever the interstellar dust happens to be made up of. And so you're getting this kind of proton plus gamma produces this neutron and charged pion. You're producing neutrinos, you're producing gammas, you're producing all sorts of things here, even before we get down. But if you can get these protons coming through, you can actually get really these protons coming towards the Earth, either the protons that were generated here or the protons that have showered on from what's going on in the medium. And each of these, so if you are generating these particles, these charged particles, these neutral pions, these neutrinos, these gammas, then you can start to think about being able to trace back and looking at what's been happening. Do your detection on Earth, but look back at what's been happening in the sky. And so this is one of these kind of plots that you see a lot of, particularly from neutrino physicists, which I guess I was one for a while. Basically, you have something going on, your shockwave, your proton, we've talked about that to death. I don't need to say that anymore for you. But then as you're producing things, you're producing all of these other stuff that's going on, all of this stuff that's being produced. A lot of it ends up producing neutrinos. I mean, this has everything ending up producing neutrinos. That's not quite, I mean, if you're a neutrino physicist, I guess that's what you think, but there's a lot of other stuff that's going on, but these are producing neutrinos, and the neutrinos then are streaming towards. And later on in the kind of talks, which maybe if you're lucky, then Darren will be back, but if not, you'll be stuck with me, and we'll actually talk about neutrinos and talk about the way that we can use those to point backwards and how they are kind of the ideal messenger. They point right back at your source. They do a lot of things that you really want your messengers to do. So we have come to something that looks like this. We have this supermassive black hole. We have the accretion disk. We talked about all that stuff. We've produced this relativistic jet of particles, and there are images of the jet. I mean, this is probably the black hole images I'm sure people have seen before, the really incredible, mind-blowing pictures of black hole and stuff. But then you can actually see the jet that's coming away from it, which is pretty incredible. So what you're seeing is kind of all of this stuff. Obviously, you're seeing stuff in the accretion disk because that's what we can see. But then if you look in differently, then you can actually see the jets that are coming out of it. And these are the jets that are being produced and producing the particles that we are going to be looking for. So this is incredible stuff. And so this is a collage, a very neat collage of the different ways we can see things with the energies on the bottom. So you can start kind of as a black hole. As you zoom out a little bit, the black hole is here, but you have all of this stuff that's being coming out of the black hole. So all of these pictures that you're seeing are the electromagnetic and magnetic stuff, the stuff that's being accelerated in the black hole, well, accelerated near the black hole, and that's coming out and that you're seeing the traces of as it goes on, which is just absolutely incredible. And shown in the bottom here, you can see kind of the energy scale for these things. So this is kind of one set of observational images. You can get, now there's a multi-instrument, a multi-wavelength search that's going on to see around these things, to kind of look and see what the acceleration, you know, jets and things look like around these things. And you can see there's different pictures. So some of these clearly are, you know, some of these are air showers, some of these are electromagnetic detectors, like looking for the EM showers. And they're all going on here. And some of these are satellite that you're looking at and you're trying to get images of what's going on. So you can see as this, you know, kind of zooms out and as you zoom in, as you're going down this corner, you can kind of generate the images to see what's going on. And this is just absolutely incredible science that's going on. All of looking at M87 in different wavelengths, different detection mechanisms, which I think is absolutely incredible. So we have talked a little bit about how to do this. The next one we will talk about is over here. We're getting to kind of these ones over here. This is really interesting stuff. These are, you know, very high energy particles. They're talking TeV energies here that are coming out. So this is where we're seeing this kind of acceleration, and we're seeing it with all these different things. What have we said? We've said that there's cosmic particle production. So protons, they're produced directly in the sources. So direct protons, we're seeing kind of energy ranges up here. If the proton managed to come to us all the way, these are the energies kind of that they would have. And they would be, you know, kind of in our extragalactic thing. If we're looking at photons, you can see basically what you're seeing is there's something has happened. You've accelerated your proton or your, you know, heavy nucleus or something, but then it's gone to pion decay. You're generating photons the same way that we talked about that doing in the atmosphere. You're also generating electrons. You've got inverse Compton scattering. You've got all of that going on. So photons really give you kind of into this range. You can't get to the same energies, obviously. You know, the direct proton, should it happen, is giving you incredibly high energy. But after it's gone through, you've showered down, you've lost, you know, several orders of magnitude. You're getting into your photons being able to measure it here, and they're more into the galactic sources. And then there's neutrinos, which you get, as we talked about, you get the, you know, the protons, you get pion decay, you get neutrinos coming in. You get a wider range of energy for the neutrinos, but the flux is lower and they're much harder to detect, obviously. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Neutrinos are very challenging. And still on this, just to, I don't know, rub it in people's faces, is the LHC limit. So where the LHC would be here, and we're still getting, you know, direct protons are still getting well above all of that. So the next stage that we'll go to is we're going to do photons. We're going to do gamma ray astronomy. So this is where my first set of slides that I got this morning end. So I will say there's a lot of references here about what you can do. If you want to email Darren, I mean, you're free to email me as well. I'm very happy to talk physics with people. But if you want to email Darren, who created all of these, his email is here. He would be, he's eager to receive all of your messages and hear what you have to say. But there's a lot of different stuff going on here. You can look up all of these things. If you want to talk about shock acceleration, there's some really nice texts on shock acceleration. We didn't get into magnetic reconnection very much. It's a different mechanism for acceleration that gets a little more complicated. So it looks like maybe Darren was planning on doing that. That's here that you can look up. And if you want to talk about relativistic turbulence, we talked a little bit about that. You can look up some sources here. So I would put up the thanks again to all of the people from which this content was borrowed. Darren was good enough to give lots of links to where all of this comes from. And I see this is slightly earlier than planned that we've ended, which maybe was bound to happen. But I'm happy to answer questions and we can go from there. You can see how it works.
I have a question. Going back to the pictures of M87, for the radio images from EHT, those are largely from synchrotron radiation, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to understand that. Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't spend a lot of time on this. I mean, this is the amount of physics that is contained in this picture alone is absolutely incredible. All of these, well, not all of them, some of them are similar, but there are many very different mechanisms for detection, going from optical to radio to, you know, x-ray. There's all sorts of things going on here, which is fascinating. But I didn't talk a whole lot about it. Sorry.
Yeah, the higher energies are just like what you were talking about, with like this, the higher energy productions of particles. Okay.
I have a question about the image. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So looking at the numbers that are noted here, so EHT is at 1.3 millimeters. What does that denote? Like, what exactly is 1.3 millimeters? Because ALMA right at the top also has 1.3 millimeters. I'm just wondering what these numbers are referring to.
I think that's the wavelength that you're looking at. So the wavelength here is in millimeters. You can see that there's the wavelength on the scale on the bottom, which is EHT and ALMA are here at 1.3 millimeter wavelength. So the difference in the two is really in the scale of the image. So you can see that this one has a 5 arc second bar that's located here, whereas EHT has the 50 micro arc seconds bar. Here. So you can see that's providing the different. So what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say the blow up as it's going down, you can see we're expanding each time into different regions. So it's just the scale of the image itself. That's what's being relayed here. Even though the image was taken in the same frequency or wavelength, either one, then it's the scale of it that's changing.
Do you happen to know what brings about such a huge difference in the resolution, even though they're observing at the same wavelength?
Oh, for these ones, I don't actually know exactly why you get such better resolution. There may be somebody there that knows more than I do about how the resolution is improved as you go down here. Certainly the wavelength has something to do with it, but I would venture a guess that at least here, we're obviously not approaching the limits of the wavelength in the resolution. It's other things that are going on.
Thank you.
That sounds like a great question to email Darren with.
Okay.
I have one. Maybe it might sound a little irrelevant about that rocket experiment.
Which experiment?
Rocket experiment. In 1930, yeah. So how do they record the data of the experiment? I assume they couldn't do it online.
This is a person after my own heart. So I got these slides this morning. I read through them, and that was exactly my first question. Was how exactly did they record the information? So I believe what was happening was they had the Geiger tube, they had it rigged up to a counter, which was actually writing to a spool. And so you could time the speed that with the spool went through to the altitude. So you could actually see what was going on that way. You'd have to unspool it afterwards. But yeah, that was my first question as well. So I really appreciate that question.
Can you explain it again? I couldn't really.
So if you have the Geiger tubes, what's happening is, you know, their Geiger tube, you're getting, actually we had something. Oh no. So much through. I've gone way too far. So we had this experiment. Come on, you can do it. This experiment where we had these things going out, right? So what you're doing is you're taking your signal, you're writing it out, and then you're essentially creating sweeps when there was coincidences. Now, this is not the same thing that they were doing in the rocket itself, but what you can do is as the Geiger tube is receiving signals, you can imagine it's a lot like, what are those things? Earthquake detectors, seismograph, seismometer, size something, where you have a spool going through and it's recording the ionization events that you're getting, right? So it's recording on this kind of long ticker tape, the ionization events that you're getting. And you know that that's going through at a constant speed. So as the rocket goes upwards, you can actually calibrate where the ionization events happened on the spool with how the altitude of the rocket itself. Does that make more sense?
Thank you, yes.
But yeah, like I said, I really appreciate that question. Doesn't mean you have to recover the rocket afterwards. So it looks like I'm about 15 minutes early. Not sure if I should start the next slides or if we should, you just have an extra 15 minutes off. Sorry, I don't know how it's been working since, you know, I just started here.
So everybody has finished on time, or we had a short break. So maybe we could do that. Like, I don't know.
So you're welcome, I guess. Probably too fast as I was going through. If other people have questions, I'm very happy to answer them. I haven't gone through the next set of slides yet because I just got those this afternoon. So it would be even more scattered than this one for me to start now.
I have a question about the plot that you showed, which had the different sources sort of as bubbles on just mapping what sources produce what energies.
What sources produce this one?
Yeah. No, there were some that had like supernova remnants and IGM and AGN.
I do remember that plot. This one?
Yeah, this one. Am I interpreting it correctly that the IGM at the bottom right corner produces the highest energy or?
Yes and no. So of course, this is only categorized by the magnetic field strength and the size, right? So IGMs are very big, but have a very small magnetic field. So when we were talking about our acceleration, we know that we need both the size in order to do this, and we need the intensity of the magnetic field. So IGMs have the advantage of being really big, right? Like incredibly big with a small magnetic field. So you can generate higher energy things there, but you're starting to get off into the range where it's difficult. The magnetic field is low enough that I believe it's difficult for them to actually generate it. So I think they're shown here primarily just because they are, you know, impressive in the size, and you could maybe do higher because of the size alone. It is possible you could get higher. Of course, you would put your next your kind of acceleration, whatever, line across here, and it would be higher through the IGM. But they would be rare to come from there.
Okay.
Sorry, but if your question, sorry, I think maybe I misinterpreted your question. If your question is that the way that this plot works? Yes. So as we move diagonally across here, of course, lower energy is down here. You're able to generate lower energies, and higher energies is moving up kind of in this diagonal, right? So in between all the planets, just in space, you know, there's a lot of regions, there's a lot of area, but a very small magnetic field. So you're able to generate particles which are of lower energy than the kind of 10 to the 20, which is being shown here. And as we said before, we already know that, you know, 10 to the 20 EV protons are very rare, at least certainly on Earth, they're very rare. So for them to get anywhere and be able to be detected is very rare, which that's kind of another axis to this plot that's not shown is how would they be able to be detected?
Maybe can you explain briefly the structure of next lecture, what things are going to be covered?
I can explain it for the next lecture, which I have seen very briefly. So the next lecture, we're going to go into gamma ray astronomy. So we're going to be doing primarily gamma ray detection. And I think that's the entirety of the next lecture. And then I am told, I have no evidence yet, but I am told that the subsequent lecture will be neutrino astronomy and the future of astroparticle observations. I haven't seen any of that yet. This is a very odd situation for me to be in, having no time to look at the slides before I talk about them. But that is what I'm told is going to happen. And I hope that that is what's going to be carried out. Certainly, gamma ray astronomy, we'll talk about the challenges with detection, the way that maybe some acceleration mechanisms for gamma rays, I believe that's in there. And then we'll talk about a little bit of the kind of future of things that, you know, air imaging, Cherenkov, all that kind of thing, detectors. And I believe that's where that lecture stops. I think I made it to the end to read all the way through. And then the subsequent lecture, like I said, will be neutrinos and some of the future, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question, though. I mean, I had the same question myself, obviously.